It is nice to be here for the Sabbath with you on a beautiful day. And I know that, you know, as we're already talking about the night to be observed, and all of that's going to be here before you know it. And for us, we began planning for the feast this week. So, it took a wild turn. So we were going in one direction and ended up going in a different direction, but it's going to be good regardless. So we're looking forward to it. And we try to plan and look forward to it. And this year we'll be going out overseas, and then the next year, 2020, we'll be staying in Texas and going to Galveston most likely. So we'll look forward to that. So this year, for those who are staying in the more local, it'll be at New Braunfels. So not too far, but a very nice place we've been before. I'd like to begin with a definition. The word that we're going to define is byword. Byword. And a byword is a person, place, or thing cited as notorious and outstanding, and outstanding example or embodiment of something. So, you know, it's notorious in the sense it's worthy of note. For instance, his name became a byword for luxury. The person lived a luxurious life and was a byword for luxury whenever you would think about that particular person. Synonyms for byword are perfect example, classic case, model, exemplar, embodiment, incarnation, personification, or epitome. And we're going to address a city mentioned in the Bible that became a byword, and it still is a byword. In other words, it's a perfect example, it's a classic case, it's a notorious place. In the sermon today, we're going to examine the city of Sodom. The city of Sodom. And Sodom is, biblically speaking, a byword. When you hear the word Sodom, you think of certain things. And the Bible makes note of it from early on all the way through to near the end and into the very last book of the Bible. And it became a byword just after the flood, not too long after the flood, and it remains a byword today, almost 4,000 years later. Now, my sermon title is Sodom, a byword. Now, the city of Sodom is first mentioned in the Bible after the flood and the Tower of Babel. And as the Tower of God shut down the Tower of Babel by confounding the languages, he forced the people to move from where they had congregated after the flood. And some of them, they moved in different directions, and some of them moved to the area of Canaan. And let's look at what it tells us in Genesis chapter 10. Genesis chapter 10 is the first place where we find Sodom mentioned, and Genesis chapter 10, and let's begin in verse 15. Genesis 10, verse 15. It says, Canaan begot Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. So Sidon, that particular city, was established by the descendants of Canaan. Other people lived there, but it was established by the descendants of Canaan. And you have Heth, which was the origin of the Hittites. And you have the Jebusite, the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arkite, and the Sinite, the Arvadite and Seth Semarite, and one more, Hamathite. And afterward, the families of the Canaanites were dispersed. So they were dispersed. These were all the descendants of Canaan, and they were dispersed at the time that God wanted them to disperse at the Tower of Babel as languages were confused. So this group basically went together. They all spoke the same language, and they moved from the Mesopotamia, where the Tower of Babel was, into the land of Canaan. And it says in verse 19, and the border of Canaan was from Sidon, as you go toward Gerar, as far as Gaza. So Sidon was the northernmost part of the land of Canaan, and it went all the way down toward Gaza. Then as you go toward Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboim, as far as Lasha. So you had you looked at the border, went across what we would know today as Israel, over towards Sodom and Gomorrah, which were more in the area of the Jordan Valley. So you had, those were the borders of where the Canaanites originally settled. And a question that, and so you might ask the question, well, why would people settle in this place that came to be known as Sodom? So why did they settle there? Well, we gain some insight into why Sodom came to be settled in the time of Abraham and his nephew Lot. Abraham and Lot and their families had gone down to Egypt because there was a famine in the land of Canaan. So they went to Egypt. However, the Egyptians asked them to please leave when they deceived the Pharaoh with Sarah, Abraham's wife, and said that she was his sister, which was literally true, but it was deceptive. She was actually his wife. So once they felt you did not deal honestly with us, they said maybe you need to move out. So they returned to the land of Canaan. And as they came back to the land of Canaan, Abraham and Lot had greatly prospered, and they continued to prosper, and they reached a point where they could no longer dwell together because their flocks and herds had grown so large, and there was conflict between Lot's shepherds and Abraham's shepherds. So Abraham said, I don't believe we can continue to live together without conflict, so the best thing for us to do is spread out. You go in one direction, I'll go the opposite, and we'll be able to avoid becoming in conflict. It says in Genesis chapter 13, verse 6, it says, now the land was not able to support them, that they might dwell together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. So they split. Abraham stayed in the area of Hebron, up in that area, and Lot made a choice as far as, well, where he wanted to go. And we note that in Genesis chapter 13, verse 10. It says, and Lot lifted his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt as you go to Zoar. So it was a well watered plain, plenty of water, a great place to grow crops. Just like in Egypt with the flood every year from the Nile River, conditions were perfect for somebody to take up residence and prosper there. Verse 11, then Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated from each other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan near Hebron, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain and pitched his tents even as far as Sodom. So as the story begins, Lot does not live in the city of Sodom. He's living in the area of Sodom. And as we well know, that's going to change. So what was the spiritual condition of Sodom and the surrounding towns when Lot moved close to them? Well, we find out about that in Genesis chapter 13, verse 13. It says, but the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked and sinful against the Lord. So already by the time that Abraham and Lot are living in the land of Canaan, the city of Sodom is known for wickedness. They were wicked and sinful against the Lord. So they weren't living God's way at all. They were living in opposition to God's way of life. And it was already made note of at the time of Lot settling in the area. Now, how prosperous were the cities of the plain? How prosperous were they? Well, we get an indication of that in Genesis chapter 14. Because we find that the five cities there had been brought into submission by the kings from Mesopotamia. So how would kings from Mesopotamia know anything about Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities of the plain? In all likelihood, the way that they learned about this was through trading. There was trading going on there, and traders would come to Sodom and Gomorrah and those cities, and as traders and going back and forth between Mesopotamia and Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities, they would note these cities are really prosperous. They do quite well. They want to buy our goods, we can buy their goods, and we'll all prosper. And so they went back to their land, and they probably reported how well things were going in the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. And the kings latched onto the idea, you know what, it's great that they're prospering, and we're able to exchange goods and make money. But you know what, would it be even better? We can bring them into submission. We can conquer them in some way and force them to give us tribute. So it doesn't detail how that happened, whether there was a conquest and a battle and they came into subjection. We don't know exactly whether it was just a threat. But anyway, they began paying tribute to the kings of Mesopotamia. And they did so for 12 years. And in the 13th year, they said, you know what? That's enough of this paying tribute. We're not paying any more tribute. So they cut off the funds, and usually for a king, they knew when things were not going well, when you quit paying them. You quit giving them tribute. So they cut off the tribute, and in the 13th year, and in the 14th year, the kings of Mesopotamia said, you know what, we're going to go fix this problem and rein these people in. So they came from Mesopotamia, and they went to battle against the kings of the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar, and they fought in the valley of Siddim, and the people that came out to battle the kings of Mesopotamia were defeated, and they all ran for it. Some of them died in the battle. Some of them ran for it. And the kings escaped. It says in verse 11 of Genesis 14, then they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They also took Lot, Abram's brother's son, who dwelt in Sodom, and his goods, and departed. So they come over, and they're going to put these cities into subjection again, and start the tribute once again. And basically, they take the goods, they take a lot, and they head back to Mesopotamia again, or the area of Babylon. So Abraham hears about this, and so he gathers up his 313 servants. Most of us don't have 318 servants to call upon, but Abraham did. And which we say, well, that's not that big of an army. But after the flood, that was a pretty good-sized army that had been put together by Abraham. So he gets his servants, and he joins with his allies, Amorite allies, and they go after these kings. And they eventually catch up to them. Abraham and his force defeats these kings, and they bring back Lot and the stolen goods. And Lot continued to live in the area of Sodom. So he did not move away. He moved, and eventually he moved into town. And as I've already noted, the city was already becoming known for wickedness, and that didn't change. It didn't change. And in fact, even though these were wicked cities, before Lot ever went down there, he moved into town. He moved closer to the wickedness. And eventually, all of this reached a critical mass, or the perfect storm, or goes over the brink, however you want to look at it, which is brought up in Genesis chapter 18, verse 16. Genesis 18, verse 16. So we have what appears to be Christ and the two angels. They show up at Abraham's place. Abraham recognizes them and said, please come in and eat with me. So they slaughter the fatted calf, and they sit down for a meal. And so they talk, and Abraham learns that he's to have a child, and Sarah laughs, and God said, well, you will always remember your laughing, because you're going to name your child Isaac. But they begin to go in the direction that they were going to begin with. And let's pick up the story in verse 17. It says, and the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Lord to do righteousness and justice, that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. And the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great. So their wickedness was renowned. It was renowned not only by people that passed through the area or knew something about them, but God was also aware of all of the wickedness. And he said, their sin is very grave. Verse 21, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me, and if not, I will know. So he's going to go down and check it out. Is this, all of the reports of the wickedness of this place, exactly what I've heard? And so he wants to know, and he lets Abraham know that his intention is, if there it is wicked as he's heard, then he's going to destroy the city. And he told Abraham. So let's go to chapter 19. So what did they find when they went down to Sodom? Chapter 19, verse 1. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. So he welcomed these two angels and bowed himself to the ground before them. And the angels tell him, we're going to sleep in the street, so we won't inconvenience you at all. And Lot says, no way. You can't sleep in the street. That is tremendous. That is unsafe. You don't want to do that. And so he would not let them sleep in the street, and invited them to lodge with him. Chapter 19, verse 4. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally. So they're desirous of sexually interacting with these two newcomers to the city, which is unbelievable that you would have such a thing. But every man from all around came and surrounded Lot's house, and they were making this demand. And so Lot said, this is not acceptable at all. And in verse 6, he says, so Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and said, please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. See, now I have two daughters who have not known a man. So had Lot been corrupted by living here? Absolutely. You can see it by his reaction. And he calls these individuals my brethren. And he said, and he talks about his daughters, and he was willing to bring them out to them. Only do not to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof. In verse 9, they tell him, stand back, they said. This one came in to stay here. So he's a foreigner. He's moved into town and keeps acting as a judge. So obviously Lot was standing up for the truth to some extent, and these people took offense at it. He's judging us. He's not tolerant of the things that we do. And he says, now we will deal worse with you than with them. Okay, you don't like what we're doing? We're going to do it to you and make your life even more miserable. So they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the doors. So was wickedness so widespread here? Absolutely. So, verse 10, but the men reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door, and they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door. So they were blinded. And the angels then tell Lot, if you have anyone living in town, you need to go out and warn them what's coming, because we're going to destroy the city. So Lot goes out and he does talk to them. But they think, you're joking. This is never going to happen. You're out of your mind. So they just laugh at him, and they don't consider at all a reality what he's telling them. These angels have come from God, and they are going to destroy the city. And so his married daughters didn't heed, his sons-in-law didn't heed, and so that was the last effort that was made. And then in chapter 14, verse 15, it says, when the morning dawned, The angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." So, and Lot dawdled around. He didn't leave. He had been warned. And finally, they grab him by the hand and his wife by the hand and the two daughters by the hand, and they basically lead them out of the city. And they're told to escape to the mountain, lest you be destroyed. And then in chapter 19, fire and brimstone is rained down on Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham, living up in Hebron, he could see down toward Sodom and Gomorrah, and he could see that fire and brimstone was raining down on the city of Sodom. So Sodom, this is basically in brief the story of Sodom. And Sodom became a byword for the nation of Israel. And God mentioned that if they would not hold fast to the covenant, in Deuteronomy 29, verse 23, he said, "Your whole land will become fire, brimstone, salt, and burning. And you won't be able to sow crops there. You won't be able to grow anything there. The land will be destroyed if you abandon the covenant which you've entered into." So he warned them. And they well knew the story of Sodom. And God said, if you will not do what you've promised to do, then your land will become like Sodom. The prophet Isaiah mentioned Sodom as well. He said in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 9, "Unless the Lord of hosts had left to us a very small remnant, we would have become like Sodom. We would have had been like Gomorrah." So they understood what this meant, because it was a byword among the people of Israel. "Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom." And God said, your country, your nation is exactly like Sodom. And he says, "Give ear to the law of our God, you people of Gomorrah." And you see, the degeneration of Israel became so complete that they had no shame. In Isaiah chapter 3, verse 9, it says, The look on their countenance witnesses against them, and they declare their sin as Sodom." Sodom wasn't ashamed of what they were doing. They weren't ashamed at all. And they do not hide it. "Woe to their soul, for they have brought evil upon themselves." So they weren't ashamed at all, and they were to be punished, and God said, "You brought this on yourself." And as the scriptures unfold, you find the term Sodom applied to Babylon. You find Sodom and Gomorrah applied to Ammon and Moab. And we find it referred to in the New Testament in Luke chapter 17, verse 26. Luke chapter 17, verse 26. So this isn't something that's ancient and has no application to you and me. You know, Jesus Christ himself mentions it, and it's a warning and a lesson for us. It's a byword for you and me as well. Leviticus chapter 17, verse 26, it begins with another byword, which is the days of Noah. That's something that was a historical reality, and the people of God are to remember that, because it's a lesson for the people of God about how they're to live. And so he mentions Noah, and he talks about, as in the days of the Son of Man, that it's going to be like the days of Noah. And in chapter 17, verse 26, it says, "They ate, they drank, they married wives, and were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all." So they went about life as normal. They weren't worried about the flood. There's this ark that's been built, but who cares? And they went on about their business until the rain began to fall and the waters to burst forth from the earth. And God destroyed the earth. But they didn't pay any attention to it, even though they had been witnessed to and warned. And then Christ goes into what he has to say about the days of Lot in chapter 17, verse 28. He says, "Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank," but it has a little bit different approach in what it says about the people living in Sodom and Gomorrah. It says they ate and they drank. That was similar to the days of Noah. But then it says they bought. It means that they bought things, they traded things, they sold, so there was trading going on here. And they had goods to trade and would trade with others, and with various caravans would pass through from Mesopotamia down through the Jordan Valley and where the Sodom and Gomorrah were on to Egypt and back and forth. So you had all this exchange of goods, and Sodom had things to trade. So they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. So life went on as normal in Sodom and Gomorrah, and it was a very prosperous life, as we'll see. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so it will be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So it's the conditions of the world at the time of the coming of Christ is going to be like Sodom and Gomorrah. And he's telling you it's going to be similar, a similar time, like the time of Noah and like the time of Lot. And in that day, he was on the housetop and his goods are in the house. Let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. So when things have reached this condition, you need to be alert. And if it becomes apparent, you need to leave. You need to leave. Lot was kind of, as I said, he didn't get out of town right away. He didn't heed what the angel said to him. So if God communicates to us in some way that maybe we need to get out, we need to get out. And you may say, well, I can't take all my stuff. Well, you maybe just better get out because that stuff isn't going to be around much longer. And it says, remember Lot's wife. And Lot's wife is a person that we remember because as Lot was told to leave, they were not to look back at Sodom and Gomorrah. And because you're leaving this behind, and there's nothing behind you there, really. And Lot's wife looked behind longingly. She liked Sodom and Gomorrah and was very reluctant to leave and saddened that she was leaving and looked back. And she paid the price for that. So the society of Sodom was busy working. As I said, they were engaged in agriculture and industry. They were making money. They were building homes, offices, factories, shops. They were industrious people out to make a buck. And by their busyness, they didn't listen. They didn't heed. They didn't realize the serious problems that existed in their society, or they had become tolerant of them. And they weren't aware of the seriousness of their situation. So that gives you some background here. Now we want to answer a question. So if somebody asked you, why did Sodom become Sodom? How would you answer? How did Sodom become Sodom? How did it get its name? So, as we've seen, Sodom was situated in a place that was well suited for the good life. It was nestled in a pleasant valley. It was ideally situated for both commerce and agriculture. And Sodom did not begin with this large city that it eventually became, or Gomorrah. There were communities that were established in that area. And as is usual, when a community is established, usually one community begins to grow more than another. There may be reasons why that, because of trade or routes that pass through, or they excel the others in what they produce. But Sodom and Gomorrah eventually became dominant. Sodom especially was the dominant community. So the question again is, how did Sodom become Sodom? In other words, how did it get its name? Every culture around the world knows that the name Sodom stands for a form of sexual deviation. And we've seen it described in Genesis 18 and 19. And the story reflects that God had reached a level of disgust with them that he wasn't going to allow it to go on. They had reached the point of no return. And as you look at Sodom, how did they reach that point? It didn't just happen all of a sudden. There was a process that took place. And what we see in the situation with Lot is the end of that process. That process had fully developed, and we see the condition of the city, and it wasn't something the way it started out. It didn't just happen. It had a cause. So we're going to examine how Sodom became Sodom here in the final part of this sermon. And many people know about the name Sodom, but they don't know the biblical answer to why Sodom became Sodom. So we'll answer that, and the answer is found in Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16, in two particular verses which we will read. In this chapter, God is reaming out the nation of Judah for her infidelity, for her betrayal of the covenant. And God mentions Sodom as a way of saying, you have two sisters that have become extinct or dislocated, and I am unhappy with you as I was with them. And to give you a feel for the context, let's read Ezekiel chapter 16 before we go to the two key verses we want to look at. In Ezekiel 16, verse 44, it says, indeed, everyone who quotes Proverbs will use this proverb against you. You know, that it's a proverb means it's a byword. It's a proverb, like mother, like daughter. And it applies to Sodom. You are your mother's daughter, loathing husband and children. And you are the sister of your sisters who loathe their husbands and children. Your mother was a Hittite and your father an Amorite. And it's not talking about their physical lineage. It's talking about they adopted the corrupted ways of the Amorites and the Hittites. Your elder sister is Samaria, who dwells with her daughters to the north of you. So Samaria became like Sodom. And your younger sister, who dwells to the south of you, is Sodom and her daughters. So the northern kingdom of Israel became like Sodom, and God punished them. He allowed them to be taken into captivity. And Sodom, he destroyed completely. So you did not walk in their ways, nor act according to their abominations. But as if that were too little, you became more corrupt than they in all your ways. So he said, you, Judah, have become worse than the northern kingdom. You've become worse than Sodom. And God says in verse 48, as I live, says the Lord God, neither your sister Sodom nor your daughters have done as you and your daughters have done. They've done worse than those wicked places. And it says in chapter 16, verse 56, it says, for your sister Sodom was not a byword in your mouth in the days of your pride. If it had been a byword in their mouth, they would have thought about it. Look how evil our community has become, and we see what God did to Sodom. Why is God not going to deal with us in the same way? But it wasn't a byword. It was completely and totally out of their minds. It should have been a byword or an example to the people of Judah. Now let's go to the two verses that are key to understanding how Sodom became Sodom. So let's look at Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 49 and 50. Ezekiel chapter 16, verses 49 and 50. And in these verses, we see how Sodom became Sodom. Verse 49 says, look, this is the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride, fullness of food, and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me, therefore I took them away as I saw fit. Now, we were talking about there's a community that looks at these verses. We see these verses referring to the deviant sexual act, but they said that deviant sexual act is never mentioned. That wasn't the problem in Sodom. But the point that they miss is, this is what the things that are recounted here are a progression. You start with the fact that you had pride, fullness of food. It's a progression, step by step, a description of a decline that ultimately led to the deviant practices that were found in Sodom. So, as I said, as you look at these points that are made in the two verses, you just see the tip of the iceberg description, and everything here is accurate. But you have to dig down into it and think about what each of those means in order to better understand why God condemned them and destroyed them. How did they get to be Sodom? How did they reach that point? So this is, as I said, it's not a random list. It is a progression. And this is not, and people miss this. So the first point that's brought up is pride. Pride. And, you know, we as human beings easily gravitate to pride. And as you think about pride, pride has a range. It can be appropriate, and it can range all the way to disgusting. We've met prideful people that are offensive, and it is disgusting when you see that level of pride. So Sodom was situated in a most excellent situation. They had a climate like Southern California. They had fertile land. The River Jordan was running north and south, and you had streams flowing down from the mountains on either side. So there was plenty of water for crops and for drinking water for the land. It was called a well-watered plain. Sodom had it better than the surrounding area to the east and west, and in that sense, they enjoyed the good life. They enjoyed the good life. And have you ever noticed that as one begins to enjoy the good life, it becomes one of the first steps toward being better than other people? Pride. I'm better than you. And you think about what the people came to there. They gravitated there because it was a very good place to live. But you forget that this was a blessing made available to us by God, and instead of looking to God, you begin to look to yourself. We're the ones who got our wealth. We're the ones who accomplished all of this. So a kind of pride, if nurtured long enough, turns to arrogance. I'm better than you. I'm superior to you. When arrogance sets in, people forget where their blessings came from. Arrogant people don't stop to look back and say, thank God for where I am. And they simply say, I'm better than you. I'm better than you. Look at what I've done. So pride was a problem that began to plague the community. It's something that was established, and it moves on to other issues, as we'll see, and there's a progression. So the next step in the progression is fullness of bread. Fullness of bread. And I don't think there's a person sitting in the hall here that doesn't enjoy the fullness of bread. I do. And we all enjoy that. And I don't think any of us enjoys hunger. So they were blessed with fullness of bread. And we are as well, thankfully. When we fast, it is a challenge. It is a challenge to go through a fast. And when the fast is over, we hurriedly go back to fullness of bread, don't we? We're probably thinking about it as the fast is coming to an end. So fullness of bread has its own series of dominoes. Implicit in all of this is as a result of the climate and the fertility, it leads to surplus. So they had plenty of bread and a wide variety of it, of fruits and vegetables and good things to eat. And so as you have a surplus, what do you do with it? If you don't get rid of it, it's going to rot, isn't it? So you trade it. You trade it for things, and there's an exchange going on. And trading usually leads to the acquisition and accumulation of wealth. But, you know, wealth begins with the land. So as you prosper on the land, then you can trade and you can begin to accumulate wealth. Wealth accumulated usually leads to desire to offload some of the wealth to enjoy some luxuries. So, you know, I like being full of bread, but you know what? I want better bread. I want Babylonian bread, or I want Egyptian bread, or I want fruits from this place, or vegetables from this place. I want some of the trinkets from these places. And the accumulation of luxuries leads to the desire to acquire even more exotic things. Think of this in the terms of coffee. You know, there was a time in America where people just enjoyed a cup of coffee. It might have been Folgers, it might have been the cheapest bean available at the market, but we just enjoyed a cup of coffee. But as time has gone on, we're not satisfied with just a cup of coffee, the Folgers or whatever. And I can say this for myself. But anyway, we want something more exotic. So we have Starbucks. So we can go and get that macchiato or whatever they call the lattes and all the different forms of drinks, you know, we pay $8 for, and we have hot ones and cold ones and all of that. Lots of variety there. And I'm not condemning. I'm just using it as an example of where we've come. There was a time when people would have just been happy with a cup of coffee that sort of tastes like good coffee. It was, the people that I knew that in churches where we attended, they always made weak coffee. Okay, weak coffee. And I'm, put a little bit more in there. No, we got to save some money. And I'm like, put a lot more in there because I want to taste it. But anyway, you don't start there, but you begin a progression. And now we've moved on to, we've got Starbucks and we expect stronger coffee. And, people are buying beans that have passed through the gastrointestinal system of a large cat. And I can't imagine doing that, but anyway, they do that. And you can tell that we're not satisfied with just regular coffee. And So I'm not just running down coffee drinkers because I'm with you. I like to taste it, and I like different things. Maybe Ethiopian beans or coffees from different places, just to test them out. But we're not satisfied as we once were with just brown water. Okay, so we want something that's got some real taste to it, and that's how these people were. They weren't satisfied with just the things that were regularly available to them, and they began to look for more, bigger, better, different, began to look at that. And as you are not careful, you can lose all perspective. You can lose all perspective, and you can become the servant of your possessions, and you can accumulate and begin to pursue excess. And you want it bigger, better, different, exciting. And just the regular stuff isn't good anymore. It's not good enough. The next thing that plagued the people here, or that was a problem, is they were prospering. And so the next thing that God brings up is abundance of idleness. The kind of quiet prosperity that gives a person more time than they know what to do with. And you know what the saying is about that? Idleness is the devil's plaything. Idle hands are the devil's plaything. So if people are idle, it's not good for them. It's not good for them. And the citizens of Sodom had tremendous amount of extra time on their hands. And so excess profits from the fullness of bread eventually found their way into recreation, entertainment, personal possessions. These things became of supreme importance to the people living in Sodom. And just as it is with coffee or food, it's the same with other things. You become bored with the regular things and you want more. So, think about where we're at today. Are you satisfied with just a dial-up phone? You've got the old black phone that you put your finger in the little hole and you'd go around and you'd dial that phone. I don't even know whether those exist or whether they work. I don't think we're going to accept that anymore. We expect a good phone, a phone that's a mini computer that we can do all sorts of things. Look at movies and check our email and Instagram and all of the things that you can do with it, which are wonderful things. But are we going to go back to those dial phones? Not unless we're forced to. The EMP drops and we've got to find something that has nothing to do with circuits and all of that. So these people became bored. And when you're bored, you start looking for new and different and more exciting things to do. Idleness is not good for human beings. The next thing seems to be like it doesn't fit with the rest of this. It doesn't fit at all, but the next thing that God mentions fits right in. It says that Sodom did not strengthen the hand of the poor. And it's part of the progression. You decline to the point where you're all only selfishly motivated, and you don't consider the poor in your land. So wealth and discretionary time create different kinds of people. Some are giving and they're involved in philanthropy. And it can also create the bored, wealthy people who really don't wish to be bothered with the struggles of others. You know, I don't want to be dealing with you homeless people. I don't care how hungry you are. I'm not interested in that. So in the pursuit of the good life, good things, and good times, with good people, the poor can mess up the picture. I was reading an article today about California and the city of Venice, which has always been interesting, but they have a homeless problem there. And you have people with expensive homes, and the homeless people are crowding in on these people, and they don't want to be hard-hearted, but they're also realizing we can't let this go on. So they're trying to figure out what they do about this. You know, it's really a serious issue in the community. So, and the easiest way for people to deal with the poor is to ignore them. Just ignore them. Don't pay any attention to them at all. And, there may be a few of us that have been to India, but one of the things that you're told when you go to India is, ignore the beggars, because there are lots of beggars in India, lots of poor people, and they're begging and they're told to ignore them. As Americans, the hardest thing for us to do is to ignore the beggars. I know in Mexico years ago, we went on a trip down there and slept on the beach in south of Tijuana, and so we're sleeping on the beach, and you know, you've got all these people coming up wanting to sell you things. And for me, I'm not a good haggler because I feel sorry for them. You know, and people that live there all the time, they don't have any trouble saying, look, I'll give you this for it, which is a reasonable price to pay for it, maybe a little bit lower. But for me, I'm not used to that, and I expect to pay the price they ask. You know, I'm comfortable doing that. But a lot of people, I'm not going to be the haggler guy. And I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying I feel compassion for them. Man, look at the ratty clothes this person has on. I remember, kids would come up. I forget whether it was Mexico or Colombia, where they're offering you chicle, which chiclet gum. Well, it was the local chicle that they were selling, and everybody's selling chicle. But anyway, it's easy to ignore them, and not do anything for them. And when a society takes a turn away from helping the poor, community is abandoned. When you say, so what, we don't care about the poor, we're going to ignore them, then the sense of community is abandoned. And you simply develop a society where you have haves and have not. And as you look in the third world, you have that very situation, the haves and the have-nots. God said of Sodom, neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor. And the poor basically fell through the cracks, and nobody picked them up. Nobody was worried about them. And it's easy to ignore them. The next thing he mentions is haughtiness. The people of Sodom had become haughty. And we have already led up to the doorstep here, because you eventually insulate yourself emotionally from the needy by creating a myth that all of them are where they are because they somehow deserve to be there. They deserve to be here. It's their fault that they're in this situation. In India, it's easy to ignore the bottommost people because there's a caste system there, and the bottommost caste are called untouchables. And if you're born into that caste, you're in that caste, and you have no chance of rising above it. And they're untouchable, so you, as the well-to-do with the money you maybe help them, you're not going to help them. You're not going to help them. It's easier to think that way than to be of help to them. In essence, you're saying you deserve to be at the bottom because of where you were born. Or you can go the route of believing if they really wanted to improve their lot in life, they could have done so. Don't you kind of think that? You know, and for us, don't you think of them as you see the people at the bottom that they're scamming you? I'm sorry, but for me, I think that most of the time when I find somebody at the gas station wanting me to give them some money so I can buy some gas, and you say, well, let's go over to the pump and I'll pump the gas in the little container for you. No, we're not doing that. I want the money. So you realize that probably they're not on the up and up. But there are times when you can't tell. And for us, it's better to err on the side of mercy than to be hard-hearted. But he's pointing out that these people had become hard-hearted. And they did not lift up the hand of the poor. And they had become haughty and looking down on people. And that's a bad place to be. When you see yourself as superior and see them as inferior, and you look down upon them and you don't want them to touch you or do anything, maybe we've missed something. And then it says, the next point that it moves on to, they committed abominations before me. They had committed abominations before me. So they started with pride, and they've worked through this progression, and the ultimate outcome of that progression is to commit abominations before God. And what happened along the way is they became immoral. And they became immoral. And the quality that came to identify Sodom was the result of what preceded it, all these things unfolding. And as I said, the listing that we've gone through is progressive. And Sodom is considered to be an outstanding historical example of immorality. But we make a mistake when we conclude that immorality is adultery, fornication, sexual assault, sodomy, and the list would go on. As I've said, immorality was not the end result of Sodom's progression. Immorality was Sodom's progression. It's what it was the whole way through. They were immoral, and they took this turn by degrees as things unfolded. So at this point, we're going to take a little bit of a deviation in order to make clear what I've been saying. And we're going to do so by looking at a speech that was given by a particular lady that probably, if you were not 60 or older, you would not remember. And the lady that I'm talking about, her name was Claire Booth Luce. Claire Booth Luce. She was a congresswoman and also an ambassador. And Claire Booth Luce was pretty much a modern woman for a long time, and then her daughter died. And with the death of her daughter, she began to look around for answers to why her daughter died and why all of this unfolded. And she was wandering around and struggling with life, and she went into a Catholic church and became aware of religion, which she was not involved in much at all. And so she began to think about religion and to have a different outlook on life than she had before. And she gave a lecture which really lays out for us how Sodom became Sodom. She gives a full explanation of what is morality and what is immorality. And so we'll just read some excerpts from her speech. She says, I'm going to read, anyway, the first question that she asked is, what is morality? She says, morals, the dictionary tells, are a set of principles, right actions, and behavior for the individual. The traditional morality of any society is the set of moral principles to which the great majority of its members have subscribed over a good length of time. So, if you live in America, America for most of its history has had a Judeo-Christian morality. It was the morality that was common in the 1700s, common in the 1800s, and was common up until probably the 1960s when it began to change. So it is the consensus which any given society has reached on what is right action and decent behavior are for everybody. It's the way the society expects a person to behave, even when the civil law does not require him to do so. One example will suffice. There is no law that requires a person to speak the truth unless he is under oath to do so in a court. We don't have to tell the truth in any other time except we're in court. Because if we don't tell the truth in court, we've perjured ourselves and there are consequences to that. But we can lie with impunity, can't we? Isn't that right? So there is no law that requires a person to speak the truth. She says in her speech, a person with legal impunity can be a habitual liar. The traditional morality of our society takes a dim view of a habitual liar. Accordingly, society punishes him in the only way it can, by social ostracism. Have you ever been around somebody that perpetually lies? What do we tend to do? I'm not hanging out with this guy because he's lying about stuff that he doesn't even have to lie about. So we tend to stay away from them. And so that's where social ostracism comes in. As she said, morality is what the majority, by consensus over a long period of time, have determined to be proper conduct for that body. Even when it is not against the law to act differently, the society will simply ostracize, choose not to fellowship, or choose not to be around. And as you look at Sodom in the book of Ezekiel, it's not out of bounds to conclude that Sodom started out as a moral community. When they first started out, they were probably moral people. But what are the traits that identify morality? Claire Booth Luce goes on to say, there is indeed a universal morality. It knows no race, no geographic boundaries, no time, and no particular religion. People, generally speaking, say you should honor your parents. People generally say you should not murder. They tend to frown on that in all cultures, all civilizations. And they tend to frown on you messing around with a person's spouse. They're married to that person, and that person is married to them, and nobody else is to interfere with that. So we have that universal morality that's found in many different places. So it goes on to say in when we look at a couple of quotes here, it says, when we study history of human thought, we discover a truly remarkable thing. All the great minds of the world have agreed on the marks of a moral person. In all civilizations, in all ages, they have hailed truthfulness as a mark of morality. We expect truth, don't we? We appreciate truth. Veracity, the English scientist Thomas Huxley said, is the heart of morality. It's the heart of morality. In contrast, in Judeo-Christian lore, the devil's other name is the liar. The liar. Another mark of the moral person is honesty. Honesty. The moral person is just. The Prime Minister of Great Britain, by the name of Disraeli, called justice truth in action. Truth in action. The moral person is honorable at whatever cost to himself, including sometimes his very life. He does his duty by his family, his job, and his country. Absolute morality, wrote the English philosopher Herbert Spencer, is the regulation of conduct in such a way that pain will not be inflicted. That is, you're going to control yourself in order that you don't do damage to somebody else. You don't inflict any pain on another person. And the moral person is kind to the weak and compassionate with those who suffer. So we see here a listing of those qualities that across societies, across continents, across religions, and across ages are accepted by the broad communities as the mark of a moral individual. And Sodom became immoral, as illustrated by the prophet Ezekiel. It became immoral over time. It didn't start out that way. And the question that comes up is, what pushed Sodom over the brink? What was the tipping point? What was the point that pushed them over the brink? Before I give you that, let me give you a few more attributes of morality so that when we get to the tipping point, you can contrast that with Sodom. Miss Luce went on to say, a moral person is above all courageous. Above all courageous, in some societies, courage stood before everything. It is what preserves liberty, lives, parents, children, country. You go to the book of Hebrews 11, it's basically a chronicle of courageous people. People who knew the truth, valued the truth, and stood up for the truth, regardless of the penalty or suffering that they went through. There's also one moral precept that is common to all of the great religions of history. It is the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Everybody accepts that. Everybody likes that. The universal morality is based on these virtues: truthfulness, honesty, duty, responsibility, unselfishness, loyalty, honor, compassion, and courage. Now, if all these virtues do indeed represent the universal morality, then what do the opposite represent? Lying, dishonesty, dereliction of duty, irresponsibility, dishonorable conduct, disloyalty, selfishness, cowardice, cruelty, and hypocrisy represent, of course, the universal immorality. As you think about what is moral and what's immoral, think about our country and which of those things I've read stands out. So let's go back to the question. What pushed Sodom over the brink? What pushed Sodom over the brink? In her speech, Claire Booth Luce continues, all history bears witness to the fact that there can be no public virtue without private morality. There can be no public virtue without private morality. So for us to be virtuous in public, in our own lives, in private, we have to be virtuous. We have to be virtuous in our own lives, and it will extend itself from our lives into the community. When you read the account in Genesis chapter 18 and 19, about God's visit to Abraham and then his visit to Sodom, I doubt that you can plug what she said into that discussion. None of that fits with the way Sodom was at that time. You see, we look at it in its story form and don't always go beneath to the mechanics. And what do the mechanics of the story tell us? And as we look at Abraham talking to Christ, he's saying, hey, if you have 50 righteous, will you spare the city? If 40, 30, 20, 10, okay, for 10, I will spare it. And in all those thousands of people that lived in the communities there, they couldn't find 10 righteous people. They didn't exist in that community. And God said, I'll see if there are 10, I'll spare it. And that's the end of the conversation. And they went forward, and sadly, the city was wiped out. As Claire Booth Luce said to her audience, all history bears witness to the fact that there can be no public virtue without public private morality. And as you look at God in dealing with Sodom, God bent over backwards to find 10. All right, we'll get it down to 10, and I'll look for 10. Couldn't find them. He was more than willing, I'll spare it for 10, and couldn't find them. So a nation that is traveling the low road is a nation that is self-destructing. And as you look at a society that's begun to have all of the immorality, you have Sodom. Welcome to Sodom. And this accumulation of traits, which began to build and build and build, as she said, all of these good things can't save them. All of them, the money, all of the good living, none of it can save them. And Christ tells us it can't save us either. So that leads us both in Ezekiel 16 and in her speech to the last question. What drove them over the brink? What indicated they were over the brink? Miss Lou says this: there is one other phenomenon which has made its appearance in all decaying societies, and that is an obsession with sex. Sex, the procreative urge, is the mighty force. Indeed, it is the mightiest force. It is the life force. But since the dawn of history, what has distinguished the man from the beast is that he has made conscious effort to control his lustful impulses and to regulate and direct them into social channels. To control himself. There is no primitive society known to anthropologists, no civilization known to historians, which has ever willingly consulted to give its members full rein. Bestial rein of their sexual impulses. No society has allowed that, and if they've reached that point, they haven't survived. Sex, morals, mores, and manners have varied enormously from age to age, from culture to culture. But sexual taboos and no-nos, sex prohibitions, and consequently, of course, inhibitions are common to all human societies. And as you abandon those, that's when you're over the brink. You know you're over the brink. And basically you begin to destroy the family, because sexual immorality will not support the family. It will destroy it. And you look at the conditions in our country, it's not very good. So in discussing Sodom, he was paralleling the condition of Israel and Judah. And Israel and Judah had become Sodom. They had passed the brink. And in Ezekiel, God says that he doesn't delight in the death of the wicked, but if you continue on this path, you will, all the wicked will die. So the name of the speech is the new morality, or more completely, is the new morality destroying America. And the new morality was the way that people were approaching morals, which was different than what it used to be. Is it destroying America? And here here is how she ended the speech. When Goethe, the great German poet, lay on his deathbed, an old friend asked what farewell message he had to give to the world. Goethe replied, "Let every man keep his own household clean. Let every man keep his own household clean, and soon the world will be clean." So talking about private morality is going to express itself in society. If not every American, but just every other American and woman would begin today to keep their own households clean, this process of moral decay would be immediately halted. And that's true. If you began to exercise private morality, it's going to manifest itself in the public morality, and it's going to make a tremendous difference. Miss Lou said that this would contribute to a strong, happy America safely into the 21st century. And we're in the 21st century, and I'm not sure that we've arrived safely, but we are in the 21st century. John Adams, the second president of the United States, made some observations. He wrote to his friend Thomas Jefferson, and he said, "Have you ever found in history one single example of a nation thoroughly corrupted that afterward was restored to virtue?" It was a rhetorical question, and the answer is zero. It's never happened. It's never happened. And without virtue, there can be no political liberty. So where is the tipping point? You know, we can see it in what happened to Sodom. We can see it in what happened to Sodom. And as you look at, you know, Romans 1 as an example, you look at Romans 1 and you see the progression being played out and described for you in the New Testament. And is Sodom a byword under New Testament conditions? Let's just look at a couple of scriptures in ending. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 6. 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 6. There it says, "And turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example, a byword to those who afterward would live ungodly." Sodom became a byword. And he says something similar in Jude chapter 1, verse 7. So we see Sodom became Sodom by a progressive process, beginning with pride, moving on to fullness of bread, abundance of idleness. She did not strengthen the hand of the poor. She was haughty, and they committed abominations before me. This all unfolded step by step. And sadly, as we look at our country, where are we? How close to the brink are we? That's the question. I don't know. I don't think any of us know. But we can see the things that are unfolding in our country, and they're not good, they're dangerous, and they're an indication of where we're at. And I think as you think about Sodom, you say, well, that's way back there. That's back in Christ's time. It has nothing to do with me. Oh, yes, it does. Sodom is a byword, and it should be a byword for us as people in the church, a reminder of what's coming if we don't get our lives together, which is a must. In our world, it may not get it together, but we have to, and abide by those things that we committed to when we went into covenant with God. So hopefully you understand more how Sodom became Sodom. And so if somebody asks you, you can say, I know where to go in the book of Ezekiel. So thanks for your attention, and please enjoy the rest of the Sabbath.